This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome all to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenes. So happy to have you here, and it is so great to have Nathan Ward as my guest today. He was an editor for American Heritage Magazine and has written for many publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Crime Reads. He is also the author of The Lost Detective, Becoming Dashiell Hammett, which was nominated for the Edgar and Anthony Awards. And he also wrote Dark Harbor, The War for the New York Waterfront. He's here today to talk about his brand new book, which just came out on September 5th, called Son of the Old West, The Odyssey of Charlie Siringo, Cowboy, Detective, Writer of the Wild Frontier. Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So what is it about Charlie Siringo that inspired you to write his biography?
Well, I had read, I guess, his first book, his most famous book, A Texas Cowboy, and I had not thought much more about his subsequent life until I was doing what is now my previous book, Lost Detective, about Dashiell Hammett, which took me to the Pinkerton Archives at the Library of Congress, which, whether you're writing a book or not, if you have any interest in crime history or American history, you just should go there for a day, check out some things that sound good, and they'll bring you old wanted posters, cipher code books, op reports, forensic files, photographs of blown up trains from robberies. It's a wonderful place. And the Pinkertons originally donated it to improve their image, which had become justifiably such an image of union busting. And they wanted to highlight the heroic things that they had done, chasing Jesse James or Wild Bunch, or, you know, all these train robbery cases, a number of which Siringo had been involved with. I was there to what I thought was to establish the early detective career of Dashiell Hammett, which is, it's the part that's always cited in his biography, but everybody's more interested in his later drunken years when he didn't publish very much at all, but he was in Hollywood and he knew everybody. But no one had really written a book about what I thought was the formative experience, which was where he got this detecting background from which he drew all his fiction. So I wanted to read a book like that, but there wasn't one. So I went to the Pinkerton Archives. They had nothing on Dashiell Hammett, although the op reports that they were required to write were clearly the literary basis for his op stories that he first became famous for. So it was well worth the trip in that sense. But what they did have was many folders with references to this Charles Siringo guy, some for his heroics in infiltrating the Wild Bunch gang and other desperado gangs. You know, he was sort of a tramp actor of the frontier. He would go around, he would track, and then he would mingle into the gang. He didn't shoot anybody. He didn't bring them in across their saddle. He infiltrated and then later testified. That was his genius. But he was well aware of what an interesting life he'd had, and he kept publishing books about it. And they sued him again and again and again. And he wrote his autobiography 5 times. And so there was plenty of paperwork from their various court cases to shut him up. And I, perhaps because there was so little going on, the thing I thought I was investigating, I copied all that. And later, when I came to do a book on Siringo himself, and then the pandemic shut down the Library of Congress and every other archive in the world, at least I had this stash squirreled away in my house to begin work with.
It was definitely fortuitous, for sure. So yeah, let's go back to Charlie and his early years. He had some tragedy in his family, including the loss of his father.
Yes, his parents were, I think, a very typical Texas story of the time, where they were immigrants from different countries who just landed and tried to make a go of it in farming and ranching. Once you get there, you would notice all these wandering cattle and change your priorities. I mean, this was the easy free money, was these things wandering around if you could hold on to them and find a market for them. And that's what ultimately created the pathways north to what became the cow towns. His father died when he was about 2, so he didn't really know him. The only father that he did know was, that gets ahead of us, but he didn't have a good father figure. Let's just say that.
So he grew up in a time of great drama and bloodshed. His schoolmaster, Mr. Hale, left his teaching position to join the war between the states.
Well, he was not a stupid fellow, I think. As soon as the war was imminent, he realized that he would suddenly be a unionist and things might get ugly for him. So if he was going to die, he wanted to die in a union uniform and from the North. So he closed down the school. Charlie had only had a couple of years of school at that point. He would try school 4 times and he never got very far. That particular case was not his fault, but later he just seemed to have a thing with authority. He didn't like being caned, for instance. He didn't like being bossed around or bullies, as he always calls them. He got in a lot of fights at school with what he called bullies. I think that may also have to do with he was a sort of a runty figure who got picked on once, at least. He lived in Matagorda, which is sort of the mid-coast, the Texas mid-coast, on the Matagorda Peninsula. When he was 12, he finally got a chance to be an honest-to-God paid cowboy, at least for a season. Then when he came back from the roundup that he had gone along, his widowed mother had remarried this northerner who insisted on selling her property and them all going north. He turned out to have weaknesses for liquor and gambling and lost almost all their money on the very ferry they were taking to New Orleans.
Yeah, that must have been rough. So Charlie ends up going back and becoming a cowboy in the mid-1860s.
He made it back alone, not entirely sure where his mother and sister had ended up. They had to find work in St. Louis. He worked in St. Louis, but couldn't find them. And then he was adopted in New Orleans by a very nice family that had no children of their own. And they put him into a private school, and he was going to learn all these languages and become a cultured businessman. And he got in another altercation with a teacher who wouldn't let him go out and see a fire. There was a very exciting fire outside the school that he wanted to be excused and go watch and then come back to class. And they That was it. And so he went and he smuggled aboard a ferry. He made it to Indianola, but he then ended up working for the famous cattleman Shanghai Pierce. And it was at that job that he learned proper lassoing, bronco busting, all the skills that would last him the rest of his life.
And at some point, right, he gets his nickname, Dull Knife. Where does that come from?
Well, he was on some kind of roundup, and after they crossed a stream, his foot was bit by a rattlesnake. And although it puffed up, he survived. And after that, he developed a healthy habit of whipping his knife at snakes that he saw in the grass from the horseback. And to the point where when his colleagues would borrow his knife, they would find it dull, and they nicknamed him Dull Knife after the chief, the famous chief. He would later use that as a literary alias, and that's later on.
What happened to his stepfather?
His stepfather, he just ran off. He had a particularly explosive drunken night, and according to Charlie, he was chased off by the neighbors and never heard from again. I mean, a couple of times he had sent them money and urged them to come meet him where he would relocate. And after that, he claims they never heard from him again.
He also saved his mother from a flood, right?
Yes, he was in close to Matagorda. They were staying with what were her neighbors. He had built her a little shack to live in while he would go on these long trail rides. And the hurricane came that wiped out much of Indianola and flooded that house and peeled off the roof. And he ended up, in his account, carrying her out of there and saving the little kids that were living in the house. They all sort of leaned into the wind in a way that I can't quite understand. I mean, every time I read it, but they did live, so it must have worked.
And he develops this ability to flit between different groups, different classes of people, social classes. He can turn on the charm when required.
Even though in his books, he will sometimes use the ugly language of that time and the frontier, they're usually in quotes, like it's a thing that's expected to be said. And there's no evidence that he ever disliked anyone that he met, unless they were cruel to a horse. But other than that, he seems to have given everyone a chance that he ever met. And, you know, it's unusual, especially in memoirs by white frontier writers of that time. There's one story which I took a long time to believe, but I finally was convinced three or four times over. But there's the story of him being shot when he was in 1875, and he would do all the cowboys, they had side gigs, and this was skinning. So cattle that didn't belong to you, but that was near death, it was okay to skin and sell the hide. If you helped it along its path to death, then you cross the line. And he had enraged a local rancher who sent a man named Sam Grant, a black cowboy who was sometimes took on killing jobs. He rode up one night to Siringo's fire, aimed his Colt Dragoon at Siringo's heart, and pulled the trigger. Siringo had he was still sitting on the ground with his knee up, holding his knee. So it went into his knee instead of his heart. And then at the same time, another black cowboy friend came riding through the trees, a man named Liege, who was holding a rifle. So Grant didn't fire the second shot and ran off, pledging to send the doctor from Deming's Bridge, which was quite a ways. It was about 20 miles away. He did that, and this guy, Dr. Pelton, was able to reach him by sunrise, remove the ball, and save the knee. Now, what's interesting to me is that he is not the hero of this story. His black friend is the hero of the story, even if the other guy is the villain. So it's unusual in memoirs of that time that he's willing to admit he owed his life to this man. So I still didn't believe the story entirely until decades later, when the doctor and Charlie had both retired to Hollywood but didn't know that the other one was there. This article came out in the Los Angeles Times about Siringo, and the doctor invited him over for a reunion where they talked about the ball. This is also according to Charlie, but recently a friend of your podcast, Mark Lee Gardner, sent me thing online where Siringo's a signed Siringo book was for sale. And when I read the inscription inside, it said, "To my dear old time friend, Dr. A.M. Pelton, the surgeon who rode 25 miles between midnight and daylight to cut a bullet out of my body." If that's not a true story, Dr. Pelton would have been very confused every time he opened his book to read.
Yeah, that's great. Wow.
And that came in after I turned the book in. Mark sent me that 2 months ago. So I was like, phew.
So in 1877, Charlie travels to Dodge City, Kansas. Can you tell us what he was doing there?
Sure. The thing about Siringo is he seems to meet a lot of famous people, but it's not an inordinate number of famous people. For instance, in Dodge City, he does not claim to meet Wyatt Earp, but he did meet Bat Masterson. And that's, when you check it out, that's exactly true. Wyatt Earp was not there the week he claims to have been there, but Bat Masterson was there running his saloon when Charlie and his friend, his trail friend, Wes, came in at the end of a three-month ride north. And the thing about these bars was there were buffalo hunters and there were cowboys, and they were rivals basically for the women who were in these bars. And the cowboys called them stinkers for understandable reasons. And his friend Wes claimed to have been insulted by one of the buffalo hunters, and Charlie was asked to back him up if there was trouble, and there was considerable trouble. Soon everybody was fighting, and Bat Masterson, behind his bar, annoyed that this had happened, was winging beer glasses at Charlie Siringo's head, which crashed on the wall behind him. Finally, Wes was cut with a skinning knife on his back, which is what happens when you pick a fight with buffalo hunters. That's their skill, is use of knives. And they made their way out of the saloon, found their horses somewhere, and rode out of town with him. He claims he was holding Wes on his horse because he was losing so much blood. He then, outside of town, he went to stitch his wound shut and saw that it was too deep because of the skill of the skinner, that he had to sneak back into town, get sticking paste to close the wound. And then they continued on to, I guess it's 15, 20 miles out of town, was D.T. Beals's cattle holding pen, where he signed on, and it was a sort of a life-changing thing. He signed on with David Beals, who was about to send an establishing herd south to the Texas Panhandle and start his LX ranch there. And so then he just sort of lucked out. It wasn't too lucky for the friend who had to stay behind, but he then ended up working at the LX ranch in the Panhandle, which is where he, among other things, met Billy the Kid, when Billy the Kid and his outlaw friend, rustler friends, decided to make camp.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I think that says a lot about his personality. He arrives back to his boss's property, and there is William Bonney and his colleagues camped out, trespassing, basically. But instead of being aggressive, hostile, he befriends them.
he does seem to have liked most people. And the thing to me that I didn't I thought was funny was, you know, they would ring the dinner bell, and Billy and his friends would go to dinner as if they worked there or had earned a dinner. And he just thought that was hilarious. He doesn't resent that, which is, I think I would resent it if they came into my workplace like that. But maybe I should work on that.
So he actually exchanged gifts with Bonnie.
Yes.
Yeah, and the two were pretty close in age, right?
They had a lot in common. They had a stepfather they had resented. They were young men who had commanded older men, and he just seems to have really admired Billy. He wrote more about him than anyone else except himself. I mean, if you add it up in his various books, there's a Billy the Kid section in each one, and he only met him, you know, briefly, a matter of days. But he had been returning from Chicago, where he went along for the first herd that went from the LX to Chicago, the Chicago slaughterhouses. And he'd always wanted to see Chicago. So, and he also got to go along on the top of the train and be an actual cow puncher, which is where they would make sure the cows don't lie down and get trampled, and they poke them with these long poles. But he came back, and these guys were helping themselves, having a campfire on his on the land there. But they, according to him, they played cards. They availed themselves of the cigars he had just brought from Chicago. And then he and Billy traded his new cigar holder for whatever book Billy was reading, which the more fanciful historians like to believe was Cervantes, because it's fun to think of Billy the Kid wandering the Southwest reading about Don Quixote. But there's no other book that has been nominated for this. It's just the book didn't stay with him either. And that's, unless it was burned, it's very unlikely to me that he would have just thrown away a book from Billy the Kid, considering how much he admired him in all his other books.
Back after a brief word from our sponsors.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she...
Or call the police.
She should have, exactly. Exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906, when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Revis Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
And we have returned. And then, in an interesting turn of events, he joins up with famed lawman Pat Garrett.
The ranchers in the Panhandle were tired of Billy and others stealing their stock. And so they gathered together what they called the Panhandle Posse, and they sent them really to get back as much cattle as they could. But if they could take part in the capture of Billy, then so much the better. But their first job was to get back a lot of cattle, which they did. He did meet Pat Garrett, and Pat Garrett had a low opinion of amateur posses, which he called a whirlwind of lunatics, which is a phrase you can't use enough, I think. But he didn't let them follow along for the final part of the arrest, escape, rearrest, death of Billy. But Siringo, for reasons that are not entirely clear, if you take the position that he liked Billy too much, he didn't want to be in a position where he might have to fire at him, that's possible. Or that he didn't want to shoot anybody, that's also possible. It was certainly an exciting and important time in his life. He really learned about manhunting and tracking, which would be such a part of his later job as a detective, but he was not a detective yet. What I was very interested in tracking down what had happened to their cattle, they were in a tan yard, and they saw the LX brand on a couple of skins. And he went up to a witness who had seen a lot of cattle going through, and he made up a sort of list, like a mugshot, of phony brands on a piece of paper with the LX brand in the middle, and said, what brand did they have? And they picked it out, the LX brand. But it's very, it's sort of like police work before he was actually in the law. I just thought it was interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah, yeah. So would you tell us about Mamie Lloyd, how he meets her?
Well, also David Beals, who was his favorite boss, sent him to Caldwell, Kansas, where he was to sort of oversee his horse stock for the cattle runs. And he did that, and two things happened there. He met Mamie Lloyd, who was then, I think, 14, but 14 was not as scandalously young on the frontier as it would be now. He met her one day when he was having some watermelon in this shop where he would go and tell tales about him chasing Billy the Kid, or, I'm sure they were not all true, but very entertaining to the kid who ran the store, who later wrote this up in the newspapers. That's where I got the anecdote. And he was there when he first met Mamie Lloyd with her father. And he proposed right away after they went to church together with her cousin. He asked the clerk for advice about how to conduct yourself in church. And then he dressed up and he went to her father and they got married. They got married within weeks. I mean, basically he couldn't bear to be apart from her for weeks at a time, like he would have had to if he stayed in his cowboying job. So he basically gave up cowboying for her. Then became he opened a business in town where he would sell ice cream, oysters, and these cigars that he made. And that was very important because he was about to turn 30 and he must have been missing the frontier terribly. He was wearing this apron. He was, sociable and making a go of it. But what he then started to do was write his memoir, of being a cowboy. And that's what became a Texas cowboy, or 15 years on the hurricane deck of a Spanish pony, was him thinking about the life he had just given up. It came out the same year as Huck Finn. And like Huck Finn, it sort of makes literature out of American slang. From that, he thought he was going to be now a literary man, even though, you know, he went to school almost till second grade, but not quite. Another thing that happened at that time that I found out only because so many newspapers have come online, and Frontier newspapers, is that he was writing a gossip column about Caldwell for the adjoining town's newspaper. And he used that dull knife alias, which is why I was able to find it through online searches. I just put Charlie Siringo, Kansas, 1870, 1880, just to see. And I got these paragraphs where somebody was saying, I'm not the author of this is not Charlie Siringo. I don't know where you get that idea. And then I noticed that the columns were written by Dull Knife, and I thought, aha, that is him. So that was a previously unknown, little thing, but it was proof that he was writing before he started writing his first book. Was that he just had to communicate, even if it wasn't using his real name.
What a combination, oysters, ice cream, and cigars.
Well, you would think that would be hard to get that, but those early trains, they had the cars that they could keep them refrigerated, and he would get it, on a certain day each week. That was one of the least likely things that turned out to be true. Was that you could get oysters or ice cream in Kansas in 1877, but you could. Well, then his first book eventually came out. And, it's sort of a self-published book, and it was sold on trains by butcher boys, and he sold a lot of them. And he was very excited by its seeming success, so he wanted to move to Chicago and be a sort of literary man. And oversee a larger second printing. That's where the publishers were that he was interested in. And so he moved his family, now with a baby and his wife, Mamie. Then money was a little slower in coming than he may have imagined. And so the Haymarket bombing happened that spring, and he was moved by the outrage and wanted to do something about anarchism. So he went to the Pinkerton's offices in Chicago, not the next day, but I think also when he was starting to run out of money, because it's about a month later. And he went in and he asked for Billy Pinkerton, claiming to know him. People who were his intimates called him Billy Pinkerton, but he'd never seen him. He sent a little note in from his banker, and he could give Pat Garrett as a reference. He was invited in. They had a little talk, and then he is the perfect set of skills that Pinkerton was looking for in a cowboy detective. And he wanted to open this office in Denver and get a lot of ranch work. And this is the perfect candidate. Except weirdly, the fact that he had already written a book about his adventures, the Texas Cowboy, that seems to have not come up in the interview, because that's. There's nothing more important to the Pinkerton agency than its secrecy and that its operatives keep undercover. But that did not come up. He signed the pledge of non-disclosure, and then he and his wife and his baby went out to Denver, and the rest of his career was assigned out of the Denver office. Largely, he would be on his own in different cases under different aliases. But the hub was the Denver office, where James McParland became his supervisor.
It's interesting. He and Mamie were sleeping when the Haymarket riot was occurring, and they heard it happening, and it woke them up, right? I think you're right. And Charlie wanted to go and check it out, but Mamie didn't want him to.
He loaned his gun to a neighbor who was trying to get him to come with him and check it out. I'm very impressed that she was able to keep him in the house because, you know, he seems to have run towards every other danger of the 19th century. But in this instance, she was able to keep him in. I mean, she couldn't make him take another job that where he wouldn't be away from her for 3-4 months at a time. But on this night, she impressed on him that maybe it was not a good idea.
So, yeah, he makes his way to Denver, and he is one of the few in the Denver Pinkerton office. And there are some office politics going on when he arrives.
The thing there was the old man, Alan Pinkerton, had always been against expansion like that because he thought that it would lead to local corruption. And in this case, he was exactly right. So a bunch of, I guess you could call them Chicago hacks, went out to establish this branch. It just became entirely a grafty. And so when he arrived, he had to live with his boss, who he didn't respect. And they would, you know, do double booking for jobs and then get paid for the ghost jobs. I mean, it's usual stuff. But because he was assigned on these trips, you know, he would go. He would be away for a couple of months in Durango or somewhere. He was not seen as a regular cast member of the corrupt branch. You know, it hadn't really rubbed off on him because he wasn't there very much. When the old man Pinkerton had it checked out and sent James McParland to take it over, Charlie was the one cast member who wasn't fired from the office. And another reason may have been because the corrupt boss had called for him to be fired so often because he wouldn't cooperate with his schemes. And that counted in his favor also.
So he learns that he is really good at traveling undercover and infiltrating these outlaw gangs. And he's rough enough and social enough when he wants to be, that he can easily move within their ranks.
He does. But I would say that his unusual talent that is, you know, if you watch cowboy movies enough or Westerns, he's not a stoical marshal. He's an actor. He would play a part. Like, now I'm the union radical, now I'm the tramp, now I'm the, you know, it changed month to month. But especially he saw that he could get the information he needed by seducing the sisters and girlfriends of the bad men he was seeking. So they would always have the letters of their common law husband with the latest address on them. That was the vulnerability that he saw, that as far as I can tell, they would always recommend him for these kinds of jobs. It didn't occur to his partner, Billy Sales, that he would be especially good at that. But Charlie was magnetic to man and woman alike, I guess, because they just welcomed him in and he would end up with the information that he needed. You can't always tell how far he took these romances, but because it's the 19th century. So when he says, I had to fall in love with her, I had to make love with her, I don't know what he means, but he did whatever it took to get the information to advance the investigation. And so that's just it's a very interesting side to it that you don't see in, you know, Gunsmoke or the shows that I grew up with.
Right, right.
I mean, but then he also makes a big deal of saying how he had his wife's permission. So that makes me wonder how far it did go. So I don't know. He's a fascinating person.
Right, yeah. So speaking of Mamie, she suddenly passes away. What did her death do to Charlie?
I can't prove that she was the love of his life, but his subsequent marriages didn't last very long, and he doesn't talk very romantically about those other marriages. But she seems to have been the love of his life, and she died of pleurisy of the lungs. There's a very strange factual problem about her death, which is in his books, he has an account of holding her as she coughed out the window in her last breaths in the winter. But when I went to get her obituary, it's in August. So it's an open question whether it was so horrible that he remembers it as even bleaker than it was as a winter thing, or if he just, as a storyteller, he couldn't resist making it as bleak as possible and putting it in the winter. I couldn't resolve this, but I was baffled because I thought for a while I must have this wrong. This obituary must be premature, but no, that she died in August. It's just one of those strange storytelling things that you can't, I just couldn't resolve it. But he clearly loved her. I don't know how he felt about his subsequent wives, whom he always would sort of install on the ranch, and then he'd go off on these missions for Pinkerton, and he'd be gone 3, 4, 6 months. And he never seemed to have quite an idea of what they were supposed to do while he was away. But Mamie, he clearly loved. She was beloved. And his daughter, he then felt that he was unable to care for her on his own. And Mamie's aunt had come to take care of her in her last days. And she begged, having no children of her own, to take the Viola with her. And that's what he did. He let her take Viola to her home. And he would see her throughout the years, but not consistently.
Yeah, Siringo had a reputation as both a talented and a troubled detective. And you write that not long after Mamie passed away, he got into trouble for clubbing and almost killing a police officer.
Yes. I think that was really towards the end. He knew that she was about to die, and he was out. I think money must have been tight because he put his favorite pistol, the old Colt's 45, as he called it, into hock, and he was going to go get it back out when he saw there had been some kind of crime in the street, and he was trying to get a better view stepping up on a windowsill or a curb, and this patrol cop yanked him down and, according to him, tore his coat. And this infuriated him, and he says that it's almost like they were both went to shoot each other, but I'd have to look back at the book. It's a confusing scene. But anyway, he was then arrested, and McParland had to come and get him out of jail, even though he had basically assaulted a cop and probably wouldn't have gotten out if not for friends like that.
So would you talk a bit about the Wilcox train robbery, which happened on the morning of June 2nd, 1899, and what role did Charlie Siringo play in the investigation?
Well, first of all, my first awareness of Siringo was when I was a boy, and I saw Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and there were these mysterious guys who keep chasing them, and finally the Paul Newman / Butch Cassidy says, "Who are those guys?" And that's the thing they keep saying throughout the film. And it wasn't until years later I learned one of them was Charlie Siringo. I mean, he's not in the exact gang that would have been chasing him as close as that, but he was part of the national search that went after the Wild Bunch gang, after this robbery in Wilcox, Wyoming, in June 2nd, 1899. What William Pinkerton did when that came about was he dispatched his two best cowboy detectives, which was W.O. Billy Sales and his sometime partner, Siringo. And they followed the gang for 4 years and 25,000 miles, not all on horseback, but if you add it all up, as he did, the train robbing gang would have included Cassidy, Ben Tall Texan, Kilpatrick, Harvey Logan, Kid Curry, George News Carver, and famously Harry Lombaugh, the Sundance Kid. They then hit another train on that line at the Tipton And the one of my other favorite things that I found out was true was, you know, if you've ever seen the film or if you've seen it four times, as I have, there's the famous messenger who won't open the door, and they blow up the car, and he, slightly concussed, comes out, George Woodcock. That was a real guy, and sure enough, they did rob his train again, and the second time he did come out. But it's just sort of things like that that you think, surely William Goldman made that up for the script. But no, that is what happened.
We will be back after these brief messages.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back once again. So Siringo was especially obsessed with Harvey Logan, a.k.a. Kid Curry, who is a particularly volatile member of the Wild Bunch.
Well, what's interesting about Kid Curry is, you know, when they started out, a lot of the lawmen thought that it was the Kid Curry gang. And we think of it now, because of the movie and other reasons, as the Butch Cassidy gang. But the Kid Curry gang was the initial thing they thought they were chasing. But what's interesting about him is that he and Siringo, they do look, they're similarly dark-complected, mustached, short men of the range, you know? And there's my favorite part in writing this book was when he appeared in Utah, he and Sales, they came out of the desert. They're covered in dust, disguised as prospectors. They had pack horses, they had, pans, and they were so rugged looking that the sheriff in this town had the hotel surrounded to arrest them, because they thought he was Kid Curry, who had just robbed this train that you referenced. They had to explain, no, we're prospectors, we're on our way into the hills to see what we can get. And they finally were let free. But I thought there's something interesting about being so undercover that you are arrested as the person that you are seeking. I just think that's when you're really undercover, is when you are mistaken for the person you're after.
How did Kid Curry die?
Kid Curry was shot he was shot and then probably shot himself. He was in such pain in Colorado, a final robbery job.
And he and Siringo were at one point in the same saloon, right?
Well, he was observed by him, Siringo was, when he was in a bar and Harvey Logan looked out from the back of the bar and said, "Who is that?" Because he was not fooled and thought that he seemed, what does he say, too wide awake to be a common criminal. So he was suspicious that he was not all that he was pretending. I enjoyed writing about this relationship because he became so obsessed. And even after Kid Curry's reported death, he refused to believe that he was dead. And even after he retired from the Pinkertons, there was a robbery in Arizona, and he was convinced that it had all the earmarks of a Kid Curry bank robbery. And so he went down there and chased around for 2 weeks and couldn't find him and couldn't prove it. But I think to the end, he thought he was alive. It was just like when you're a missing limb, it just feels like it's still there and you can't stop thinking it's there.
Right. So why does Siringo part ways with the Pinkertons?
Well, there's a famous trial of Bill Haywood and others, of the mining executives, mining union executives, in Boise in 1907. And at that trial, Clarence Darrow basically put the Pinkerton organization and James McParland in particular on trial for all their anti-union sins. And I can't prove that sped up his retirement, but he did retire right after that, as if he knew all that, but hadn't heard it all said in one place like that before. Also, he had, Siringo, that is, become such a public figure at the trial because he was guarding the assassin, Harry Orchard, who had blown up the former governor, Stoudenberg, who had been blown up in front of his house. And he would escort him to and from the courthouse to visit him. Siringo had to bring you in. And he was in the newspapers all the time. And I think it was be hard to go back to undercover work after having become so public. They offered him sort of branch head jobs, and he had no interest in running an office. He just didn't think it was very exciting. So he retired and promptly started to write his memoirs, which was the struggle of the rest of his life, was publishing, being sued by the Pinkertons, publishing another one, being sued by the Pinkertons. That was his life to write about, is how he saw it.
And despite the fact that the Pinkertons were in the crosshairs of Clarence Darrow, Siringo still alerted Darrow to a possible lynching.
That's right. At the end, even though the Pinkertons lost, and after Darrow's 8-hour summation, he did hear that a train full of vigilantes was on their way to hang Darrow and the whole legal team and the defendants. And so he went to the hotel in Boise. He alerted Parlin, who had alerted the governor, and he went to the train and talked them down when they arrived. So more than anybody, Siringo had been in so many of these situations himself where he was discovered and a mob came to throw him down the mine shaft or hang him, that he could identify, and didn't wish that to happen to Darrow just because he, as he said, believed in the underdog.
Right. So Siringo continues pursuing his writing career, penning a book called Pinkerton's Cowboy Detective, which puts him at odds with his former employer.
Well, that was the original title, was the correct Pinkerton's Cowboy Detective. They then took him to court, and it took about 2 years of struggling in court. Every client's name had to be changed. Even his boss had to be changed from McParland to McCartney, and Pinkerton had to be changed to Dickinson. So it ended up as just a cowboy detective. 22 years with the Dickinson National Detective Agency, which everyone knew was incorrect, but the rest of the anecdotes were so authentic, whether the names were correct or not, that it was very popular, and it was a big influence on the hard-boiled fiction writers, because these were, you know, real detecting cases. The guy comes into a town who needs to be liberated from a gang of thugs. He works for the client, whichever side is the client. These are the stories that became the op stories with Hammett, which significantly, Hammett never mentions Pinkerton in his stories. It's just the Continental Op Agency. And I think he took as evidence of what had happened to Siringo, as don't mention the Pinkertons and you'll be okay.
So what prompts his move to Los Angeles, to Hollywood?
Well, he was pretty broke from all his lawsuits, and he got bronchitis in 1921 on his last hunt into the mountains of around Santa Fe. And so he finally had to give up the ranch and put down his horse and sell his remaining animals. And he went to California. He stayed with his daughter for the worst of it. Then when he was recovered enough, a couple of months there, he had gotten a letter from one of his old friends, Dr. Pelton, that he should come out to Hollywood because there was nobody with his skills at writing, shooting, roping, making movies. And so he got out there probably a little too late for that kind of stunt work, but he had so much authentic tales that he could offer the movie makers that he started making the rounds, selling his self-published books out of a satchel, and everybody he made friends so easily. They would take him around and to parties in the Hollywood Hills. Nobody really hired him until William S. Hart finally did, which is surprising to me because there were so many unauthentic movies being made at that time. You would think that having the okay of Charlie Siringo on your script would have helped it, but I guess there was people were so crazy for cowboy stories, no matter what kind of stories they were. They didn't need his specific story, and he wasn't famous for being himself because he had always been all these other characters. He wasn't like Wyatt Earp or Bat Masterson. He had been many other people undercover on the West.
He becomes kind of a drugstore cowboy, right? What is a drugstore cowboy exactly, and does Siringo fit the definition?
Well, there was a cowboy bar at the time called the Waterhole, which was walking distance of his apartment in Hollywood. And before there was a casting office, if you needed cowboys for tomorrow's Western out on the Paramount Ranch or something, you would come by there and grab a few and pay them a day rate and give them a lunch. By 1929, the Waterhole was closed, and the place to hang around waiting for cowboy work had moved to an actual drugstore near the Paramount lot. And that's where the phrase comes from. They were allowed to use the phone there and call in to see if there's any work. They could eat cheaply. They could see, which of their friends was there and might have a tip about a place to get work that day. And that's where the drugstore cowboy phrase comes from. I don't know that it would have applied to actual cowboys like him, but those that were hanging around waiting for work in cowboy movies, yes.
And he dies in 1928. Is his career remembered in obituaries, or does he die in obscurity?
Well, it's funny. He did get obituaries, but he had just gotten a lot of press for his last book, Riata and Spurs, which he had through some of his Hollywood friends. he had convinced Houghton Mifflin that he could do a final book, all his autobiographies in one. He could tell the cowboy story, the detective story, and all, and that it was long enough from since the last one that the Pinkertons would let him tell everything with the real names. And they said, well, that sounds great. And this, and he seemed like such a genial old guy. And this book came out. It got wonderful reviews. It was he was seen as a symbol of the lost frontier, of everybody's grandfather's stories, But the Pinkertons had not forgotten. And so as soon as it came out, they started getting letters from their lawyer, John Brown, who cited all the previous injunctions. And the poor Houghton Mifflin had to take out about 100 pages of the book and replace it with what he had hoped would be his subsequent book called Bad Men of the Old West. So that much of his detecting stuff came out altogether. So if you are writing a book about Siringo, for instance, it's very useful to get the first edition of Riata and Spurs, which I did. It cost about $200, because then you can check all the names that were changed in the other books, or the edition that exists now of Cowboy Detective in paperback. Those are all changed names, and a lot of them make their way into Western history books as if they're the real deal. There's like these two mining executives who were blown up, and he did an investigation of a dynamite ring in Tuscarora, Nevada, and they changed those names, and you'll see those come up again and again in books about Siringo, or articles about Siringo, as if those were their real names, but they're perfectly easy to look up in an old newspaper.
So is there a place we can go maybe to catch a glimpse of Charlie Siringo in a film?
He did have a few seconds in William S. Hart's final film, Tumbleweeds, which if you do go on YouTube, it's about 57, 58 minutes into the film. It depends on which version. There's a newer one where he's like a couple minutes earlier than that. But anyway, you see him. He's got a big hat. He's so leathery and tan. He's sort of shiny. And he's playing some mysterious instrument that's out of frame. And I make the point in the book that this movie failed. For one reason was Hart wouldn't cut it down from 8 reels to 5, which is what the producers wanted. But if he had done that, he certainly would have cut out weird little cameos of his friends, like Siringo's appearance. But so thank God he did. He didn't cut it down. Although it's too bad because it was the last film he made. It was such a failure. But it's pretty great to see Siringo up there in this Caldwell Saloon. It's the night before the big Oklahoma race, and there he is. He's not big as life. He's little. He's a little guy, but he's it's sort of miraculous to see him.
Wow! Did you have to search for him?
I did. I had always heard that he was in the film, but it took me a while because you can miss it if you're too impatient.
Right.
But for one thing, he looks so uncomfortable that he's obviously not one of the actors, and he's so old that he's obviously not one of the actors. So after a while, you sort of figure out, well, that must be him.
Wow. Gosh, it's so fun to learn about him. He's not one of the more well-known Old West characters, but he certainly should be. Don't you think?
I mean, not for his lack of trying. If you publish 5 autobiographies and people still don't know you, then that's on them.
Right, exactly. So for people who want to connect with you, learn more about your work, where is the best place to go?
Sure. I mean, I have a website, NathanWardWriter.com, or they could do things through Grove Atlantic. You could go through them. Oh, but on that website, it has the way to get in contact with me.
Excellent. Well, I so appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, I have been speaking to Nathan Ward. He is the author of Son of the Old West, The Odyssey of Charlie Siringo, cowboy, detective, writer of The Wild Frontier. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.